know you're broken hearted, cause the peace you're hoping for is off a scene's departed. Thoughts and feelings often disregarded, so we're stuck here trying to stop what some others have started. Standing up to
ladies and gentlemen, welcome to We Love No Other podcast from IlliniBoard.com. I am your host, Robert Rosenthal. My guest today is somebody I don't really know that much, and you probably don't know, but he has a fascinating story, and I wanted to talk to him about it. So I'm going to learn about it at the same time as you learn about it. So I am talking to assistant baseball coach Kurt Courtright. Kurt Courtright. Okay, let's just start with your background. How long you've been in Illinois? Why you came here? I read your bio. I saw your baseball background goes back to, I think, Missouri State. I think you grew up in Illinois. So just take me through baseball and you and what you did and, you know, what led to Illinois.
Yeah, so born and raised in Lincoln, Illinois. Played college baseball at Missouri State. From there, I played a little bit of independent ball, pro ball, and then
it was Gateway Grizzlies, right? Like,
correct, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, Gateway.
Yeah, yeah, I'm from the St. Louis area, so I'm from the Metro East there is where I grew up, so awesome, I know Gateway Grizzlies quite well.
Yeah, so played that for a little bit, and then I knew I wanted to get into coaching. Went back to my hometown, became the head baseball coach there at a pretty young age, and learned a lot, kind of thrown in the fire. And then I was there for 3 years, decided I wanted to get to the college level, got a break and got to a junior college for a year. And then I went on to Eastern Illinois University, not too far away, for three years. And then got an opportunity to come here. So I'm going on my third year here at the University of Illinois.
Got it. Okay. So you, let's see. So then you were here for the 2018 season? Was your first season spring of 2018?
Correct.
Okay, and then 2019, and then of course 2020 with kind of a, how many games did you guys get in?
I don't know exactly, but 15-ish. It was like 15, 16, something like that. It wasn't very many.
Yeah. Okay, so around that same time, and this is why we're talking. I guess it was. Was it last fall that you got your diagnosis, or fall of 19, I guess it was?
Yeah, so last fall, I don't know the exact date, somewhere, I think it was around October-ish, mid-October is when I found out that I had testicular cancer, and then kind of just went from there. It happened in a great time, to be very honest, because that's when we're wrapping up the fall, and I'd say the only off-season that we really do have is the winter, when our guys go back home for Thanksgiving and Christmas. And so that's when I was able to do all my chemotherapy, and I didn't miss anything when it came back to the spring. I didn't miss a single practice or any game. So really fortunate.
Wow. And so how long was the process from diagnosis and chemo and everything else for you?
So I had to have surgery, and then I believe a week or two later is when I started chemo. When I first found out I had cancer, I wasn't too worried. I don't know why I wasn't. I think the doctor told me, hey, you're going to be okay. So I just said, okay. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really think a whole lot about it until I went in and he told me the plan to treat it. And that's when it kind of got real for me. I had to go 21 rounds of chemo.
Wow.
So I went Monday through Friday. There's probably 6-7 hour days, Monday through Friday. And then I would take Saturday, Sunday off, and I would go Monday. I'd get a week off. I'd go Monday again, take a week off. And that was basically one round. So I guess I had 3 rounds of that. So yeah. I had three straight Monday through Fridays, and every Monday as well. So it took a while, and it took a toll. But like I said, I'm very fortunate that I had a better diagnosis than some people do. So
yeah. You know, I realize as you're talking here that, you know, if we're talking about the subject, it probably should be an awareness thing. Like my wife's brother passed away of testicular cancer, like at age 14. Like it was, you know, a very rare thing for a child. But so it's, you know, I'm aware of it. So how, if you don't, I mean, this is like a touchy subject, but like,
okay.
How did you know? How did you discover? What did you do immediately? You know, was it a long process or was it like, I better go get something checked out? What was it for you? Yeah, well, I know it's touchy.
No, it's okay. I'm okay with it. The reason I'm laughing is I'm not very smart, and I don't like doctors, and I just kind of, I don't really worry about things like that. I knew for probably a month and I didn't tell anybody. I knew there's a problem. And just like probably a lot of people, I WebMD'd it, you know, I Googled this and I mean, the 100 other times I've done it, it said I had cancer too.
And right.
It was nothing. It was nothing. Right.
Right.
But this one, I clearly remember reading the symptoms and I about passed out because I was like, man, that is spot on. And it's gotta be it. So I, unfortunately, I waited a little longer than I should have. I didn't tell anybody. I didn't tell my family or anybody.
Yeah.
How I knew was it was my testicle was about four times the size of the other one. Mm-hmm. No pain, didn't hurt, no pain, nothing like that. It just it was very, very big.
Yep.
So compared to the other one, and that's kind of how I knew. So
went
to the doctor and he felt it for maybe a half a second and said, okay, we got to get you to go. You know, he knew immediately. I knew immediately.
Yep.
And so the process after that was kind of a whirlwind, to be very honest. Everything happened so fast. I gotta give a lot of credit to the doctors and the people here in Illinois and Carl Cancer Institute. I mean, they took care of me unbelievably. And I'm just really fortunate it worked out the way it did, obviously. And, it's kind of all a blur, especially, you know, those first couple weeks. A lot happened, a lot of tests, a lot of x-rays, you know, surgery. I had to get a port put in and a lot of stuff had happened before chemo.
Yeah. And the, like, how was your recovery process with the rounds of chemo? You know, you hear various stories from people of, you know, couldn't move for a week versus, you know, some were like, it wasn't as bad as I thought, or my body didn't take too rough to it. You know, what was your process?
Yeah, it was different. It seemed like it was different every day. And I guess that, I think that might be the awareness level of, I didn't even know what cancer was, really what it was to a scientific fact.
Yep.
I didn't realize that everybody has different symptoms to the same drugs. Everybody reacts differently. So there was a lot of worse, you know, there really were, but one of the worst was the steroids made me want to eat so much.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been somewhat healthy. I've always been, you know, active and all that. And all I wanted was fast food five times a day. That was the only thing that would like fill a void. I gained 35 pounds during chemo.
Wow.
I thought going in, going to lose weight, you know, when I thought cancer, you know, that's me being ignorant and not understanding.
Sure.
I thought, oh, cancer patients, they get sick and they lose weight. And I gained a ton of weight. I ballooned up.
Wow.
So that was different for me. That was hard to handle. The other thing, even though it seems like it's contradicting itself, was I had mouth sores that were so bad. I felt like I had a million razors and needles in my mouth and in my throat.
Wow.
I think at one point my tongue was completely white. All the skin had basically peeled off.
Wow.
And so it was really hard to swallow.
And that's a reaction to the chemo? Like
Like
your doctor said that was specifically tied to that?
Yeah, I think it was one of the drugs that did it. I think it was called cisplatin, I believe. I got three different types, and I'm not smart enough or understood.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly didn't want to know. I knew it was kind of scary when the people that are putting the chemicals inside me are wearing hazmat suits because they can't get it on them.
Mm-hmm.
But yet it's going into me for, you know, 6 or 7 hours. It was kind of scary.
Yeah.
But just crazy symptoms all the time. All of a sudden my ears would start ringing. Every single Monday I would get a giant fever. I think it had to do with the certain amount of drug they gave me, but I would get home, I'd be a zombie. I'd go to bed, I'd wake up a half hour in a pool of sweat, overheating, and then just get a crazy fever.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to go to the ER the first time it happened. And I stayed there. They kept me there for 3 or 4 days because I was neutropenic, which I don't even know what that means, but mm-hmm. I remember that was the term.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second time it happened again, but I didn't go to the ER because I didn't want to stay there for 3 or 4 hours.
Yeah.
And I remember my oncologist being very upset with me when he found out that I was running 102 fever and I didn't go to the ER because I knew, I don't know, since the last time I knew, I'm like, all right, I'm just going to go through this fever for, you know, 8 or 10 hours, and then I'll be okay. So
right.
That's yeah. So it's a lot of different things happened, but it was tough. You know, it was tough. But I was fortunate too. I had a lot of support. You know, I had a lot of people behind me. A lot of people visiting, phone calls, care packages. My girlfriend at the time was with me every single appointment and chemo and everything. My family was behind me. I kept my family from coming a few times because they were probably a little too supportive.
Yep.
I wanted them, I kind of wanted to deal with it in my own way and kind of be a baby. You know, I kind of wanted to just let me be me, you know, let me feel sorry for myself for a couple days here.
Sure.
Which they didn't like that, but I knew that, you know, they had my back, anything I needed. So it was much easier with the support I had.
Yeah. How long had you been in Champaign? Like, when did you move to Champaign for the job? Was it beginning of the school year in that year?
Pretty close. I believe it was in July.
Okay.
Middle to late July. Okay. And then, you know, school started, you know, late August, early September.
Got it. And so then what was the exact time frame of how long you'd been here and when you got the diagnosis?
So I was here for a full season.
Yep.
So I guess about a year and a couple months.
Yeah.
About a year and a couple months. So, yeah. And then I think, I guess I'll always remember my surgery date because 24 hours after my surgery, I was tailgating with my friends when we beat Wisconsin. And
really?
I ended up running on the field because I was so excited. About 26 hours after surgery. So,
26 hours after cancer surgery, you were on the field for that is amazing.
Yeah, I had them move up my surgery because for like 3 months I had a bunch of my friends coming to tailgate for the game.
Uh-huh.
And we've been looking forward to it, and then I get this diagnosis and then they're like, hey, your surgery is going to be Friday, and I'm like, no, we can't do that, my friends are coming, can we bump it to Thursday and that way I'll be ready to tailgate Saturday.
Yeah.
And somehow that happened, and then we beat Wisconsin, and it was awesome.
That's amazing. I guess I'm surprised you could move around. Like, you know, I'm not going to ask you to go into the details of the surgery because everybody but like, I'm just surprised you can move around like 24 hours later.
It was tough. It wasn't very smart. And
is your oncologist learning of this right now? Your surgeon.
I kind of told him.
Well, there you go. So then, you know, that happens, and you spark a 4-game winning streak for Illinois football.
That's right.
That had to be it. That was the moment. So then chemo was throughout the winter, and you say you were back first game of the 2020 season. You were like on the bench, like there for that, like that first road trip or whatever.
Yeah. I was still in batting practice in January.
Okay.
Now I couldn't throw as much. I would go shorter rounds because my, mm-hmm. you know, my immune system, my energy.
Sure.
It took me, you know, very, very too long to get back to normal. But yeah, I was still in batting practice, and it was good to, you know, it was great to be back. It was a great you know, release for me, mm-hmm. To be able to get back to somewhat of a normal life and a schedule and being able to see our guys and our coaching staff.
I mean, sure.
It was almost therapy for me, to be honest, be able to get out of the hospital and go, you know, get back to normal a little bit.
Definitely. And that, you know, duties wise with the assistant coaches do you throw a lot of BP or, you know, what's your role there?
Yeah. So I work with the outfielders, do base running. I throw BP a lot. I enjoy it. The guys say they like it, so I don't, you know, mm-hmm. for whatever that's worth, but throw a lot of batting practice and usually do scouting reports on the other teams and help Adam, Chris, our assistant, with hitting whatever he needs it. And that's kind of my roles.
Okay, before we get to the other stuff, I want to ask a BP question. So you're behind the net, I'm assuming, or the uh-huh. fence or whatever.
Yep.
I've watched BP before, and it's like this different throwing motion for, I guess, shortened for rapid fire kind of thing. Is that the case? Like, you know, I'll just be at a professional game watching BP and like, you know, the guy's barely thrown his arm back to just, you know, he's almost wristing it in there kind of thing. Is that the case, or is that just some people do it that way and you full wind up the thing or what?
Yeah, I think it depends on each guy. Some guys are different. I was a shortstop, and so I kind of have a longer arm action, like a three-quarter slot. And so I think my arm action is a little bit longer than most people. Mm-hmm. But I also like to throw it a little bit harder. Mm-hmm. So I typically, the screen is back a little bit further than probably most people.
Interesting.
And I try to make it more of a game speed reaction than just kind of toss it in there nice and easy and let them feel good. I try to you know, put a little bit on it so it's a little bit more game-like for them before.
And what's the key? Like, what, you know, when guys say they like you throwing BP, is it the action on the ball? Is it the speed? Is it the accuracy if you can hit a spot, or what, you know, what is it?
Well, you'd have to ask them. I would think, you know, just the speed and the accuracy. And if they want to work on a pitch away, they know I can get it there. They'll say, hey, will you work me away this round? And I can throw it on the outside part of the plate for them or in. I can throw breaking balls for strikes. I can throw changeups. So I can mix off speed pitches in. I would say I don't know the percentage, but 97 out of 100 are probably strikes. So I think they like that, just that it's consistent.
Mm-hmm. So what's the? I guess I've never really thought about it. I mean, I have 1,000 BP questions in my head right now, but like, you know, what is it typical that most college staffs have one guy who throws BP, or is it just like, okay, there's five assistants, this guy's the one everybody likes, or this guy has the best like arm to do this? Is it something like that, or is it just, you know, like when you were hired, or, you know, when Hartlib says, hey, are you good at BP because I need a guy, or something like, you know, what how does that work?
Yeah, I think that does happen at some programs. I've actually heard of coaches hire, you know, hey, can you throw BP, and some guys can't and they don't get the job. I've actually heard of those. I didn't have to audition. I do believe he asked, and I think I said, yeah, I can, you know, I'm good. I can do this. No problem. So, but I get a lot of help too, especially honestly, when I was going through chemo, when we were doing individuals, you know, Coach Chris and then our manager, PJ, they threw all the time. Mm-hmm. And for a manager, PJ, he's very, very, very good mm-hmm. at BP as well. So, me and him, we switched a lot this fall, just kind of every other day. Mm-hmm. I throw a little bit more than everybody else, but
yeah,
we all kind of mix it up a little bit. Every once in a while, Coach Hartlib gets in there and he can still chuck it. It's pretty impressive. He can still throw as many strikes as me, and he puts it in there pretty firm. So.
And how are you with the fungo? Is that even a thing anymore? Is that still a thing?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. I can swing a fungo a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. Okay. So, let's fast forward. So you go through this season, you're back with the team, you get maybe 15 games, COVID shuts everything down, the world flips upside down, and you said you would, you know, I'm going from things you put on Twitter that, you know, you went through this stage where you were reacting to the food of, or, you know, you gained your weight or whatever, and that's how you reacted to chemo and everything else. And then you decided to do this, I don't even know what to call it, extreme race. What's the proper term I can use here?
Proper term is, it's called an ultra marathon or an ultra. That's typically, an ultra is considered, I think most of the time it's past 50 miles is considered an ultra.
Got it. And you had done this before, is that correct?
No, I had never done a race like this. So what I had done before, it's called the world's toughest mudder. So it's tough mudder, or like a Spartan race, the obstacle course racing.
Right.
It was that, except for it was the world championship, and it was a 25 and a half hour long race. And you basically have a 5 mile lap, 35 obstacles, and you run as many laps as you possibly can in 25 hours. And so I had done that three times. The first year I got hypothermia because a sandstorm hit at about midnight and I was just freezing cold and you're constantly in and out of water. And second year, the opposite knee, but basically the same thing happened that happened this race. It locked up on me and I was probably the strongest I'd ever been, and I was kicking butt, to be honest, about midnight when it happened. And so I knew I had to go back one more year, and I told my family, I was like, this is my last one of World's Toughest Mudder. And so they all went, my entire family. I got a big family. So I went there and everything went as planned, and I ended up running 75 miles. And, I think I 35th out of, I think there's like 1400 people.
Wow.
And so I was like, yeah, I reached my goal. I'm done with these for now. Like I guess I don't want to say live a normal life, but I trained for 3 straight years, for 3 races, you know. It's tough to train just for one race a year.
Yep.
And the reason I did that was because my baseball schedule. I mean, baseball was number one to me, you know, my job and my career. And so the baseball season's so long and so hectic, and you're always, you know, traveling and have stuff to do, that the races I can only do are usually November, December. And those are the only 2 months that we don't have stuff going on the weekends. So, so I did those 3 races and then took some years off, and then I found this race and I was like, man, that is right up my alley. I love that, because I wanted to go further than I ever have. I wanted to go longer than I ever have. I met one of those goals. I didn't meet the other. So,
okay. We'll get to that in a bit, because I have about 1400 okay. questions here. let's go back to hypothermia and sandstorm. So it's as many laps in 25 hours. And is that the type of thing of, like, some people will go 30 laps and then rest and then try, or some people will just go as many as they can till they crash, or some people will do a lap and then rest every time? Is it, does everybody do the same, or how do they do this?
Yeah. So that one's all on yourself. It's whatever your strategy is. You have a tent. So it's called Tent City. So the way I can say, it's kind of like a NASCAR race, right? Your start finish line is right there, and you have a pit stop. And your pit stop, you have your tent, you have all your food and clothes and anything that you think that you might need to bring. And so when you finish a lap, you can go in the tent. You could sleep for an hour if you wanted, or you could grab something to eat and get back out and start another loop. The loop's for 5 miles, 35 obstacles. The obstacles were crazy. If you can imagine American Ninja Warrior, it was a lot of those. You get electrocuted. Usually I got electrocuted 2 times every lap. It was brutal. Jumped off a cliff. So it was a 35-foot cliff jump into the lake every single lap. And at night it got kind of scary. So,
okay. Now I have 1300 more questions. How electrocuted? Like, what's
10,000 volts? 10,000 volts. So the one was called Operation, and it's exactly like the board. It's exactly like the board game. You're holding the metal pole, and you go through this ring, and on the outside of that ring, it's lit up with electricity. And if you hit your pole on the outside of the ring, you get electrocuted. The worst part is you're standing in water. And so if the person next to you gets electrocuted, so do you. And so that part was pretty tough.
You're guiding the pole through and not touching either side, and the person next to you hits it and you get electrocuted.
Yeah, yeah. And if you drop your pole, that's a penalty. If you drop it, now you have to go. And I think the penalty for that was a sandbag carry through, I think it was about a quarter mile. And I know you had to go through 2 tunnels where you had to, like, chuck it in the tunnel and then go in the tunnel and push it out. And, like, those don't even count towards your totals, toward your total laps or your total miles. So when I ran 75, I actually probably ran closer to 80 to 85 just because of all the penalties. So every obstacle that you don't pass, then you have a penalty. I remember one year I had basically 2 miles of a cinder block carry that didn't even count towards my total because I failed an obstacle 8 times and about a quarter mile cinder block carry. So there's some brutal ones.
So how many times did you, like, let's just take the last race you did of that one.
Okay.
How many times did you go through, like, do the full circuit?
15.
Okay. And how many times of the 15 did you get electrocuted?
30.
So there were 2 electrocution ones.
There were three. Okay. Actually, it's probably over 30. So there were 3 electrocution ones, and then the operation. Operation, I got electrocuted, I think, 3 or 4 times. One time I held on the pole. The other 3, I screamed obscenities and dropped the pole because it scared me and it hurt.
Sure. Yes.
So, yes. Yeah. But then the other ones, one is called Electric Eel. You're on your stomach going through water, and they are dangling wires that are hot above you. Mm-hmm. And so if you raise up a little too far, you get electrocuted as well.
Okay.
And then another one is called electroshock therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically dangling wires that you have to work your way through. Some of them are hot, some of them aren't, and you don't know. So.
And so when you're doing those things, you're pretty much every time you're getting shocked.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yep.
And you probably paid to be able to.
I paid a lot of money to do that. I paid a lot of money to be able to torture myself. Yes.
What was the hardest, like physically, what was the hardest obstacle of those? Like what was the hardest one to conquer? Not just pain wise, but like physically do it.
Physically, the ones with grip strength, I got a little bit small over hands and they always swell up. I don't know why. I don't know if it's the water that gets trapped in there, but my hands always swell up. So my grip strength is gone.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a couple that are called, I think one was called double rainbow, where you jump and you're out over water and you jump onto a handle, and that handle, I don't know the right word, pendulum. I don't know. It swings you. Mm-hmm. And then you have to jump onto another one, grab that, and then that one will get you to land. That was probably the hardest one, because as soon as I jumped and I got, I'd say straight up and down, my grip strength left. Mm-hmm. And I go in the water and now I'm freezing cold. Mm-hmm. And then I'd have to do a penalty. So that was probably the hardest one. The scariest one for me was always the cliff jump. It was always at the end. You know, you'd already ran 4.5 miles. You've already gotten your body beat up, and now you got to jump what seemed like 100 feet. And you got to jump in this water at night and then swim forever and then climb up a cargo net. Like mentally, that one was probably the hardest for me.
So when you got hypothermia, like it's actual, like a doctor there saying, we're shutting you down, you have...
Oh, everybody. I mean, I don't want to say everybody. Most of the competitors got hypothermia. Yeah. Complete shaking, nonstop, crying in my tent, just... bawling, just shaking and shaking and shaking and shaking for hours. I finally went back out. I don't know how. I think it took me 2 days to get my body temperature to stabilize after that. I didn't feel my big toe on my left foot for, I think, 2 weeks. I think there was some frostbite or something going on there. I mean, it was not good.
Yeah.
Not good at all.
Have you ever considered the military?
I did. I always told my family if my right arm went bad that I would go in the military. But fortunately, I could play baseball a little bit, so I kind of went that route. But
right.
I love that stuff. I absolutely love any military, Navy SEALs. I love everything about what they do.
Yes, and that's where I was going with this. I was in a wedding, like this is like 20 years ago, and one of the other groomsmen was a Navy SEAL. And we're sitting around in the groomsman room, like, you know, it's like 2 hours. We got the pictures done. Now we got to wait 2 hours for the wedding. So I'm just grilling this guy with questions of like, okay, well then what was this and what was this? And he was talking about, you know, SEAL school or whatever it is in San Diego and how they do it. And his story actually lined up with the, you know, a lot of the movies that you'll see. You know, his story that the hardest thing was, like it was a 52 degree evening or something. They took him somewhere and they had him like laying on cold concrete. And they were spraying him with a hose. Mm-hmm. And they had, you know, like only wearing underwear and this. And that was what he was talking about. It's like your body is shaking to where it almost gets to a point where you don't even, like you realize it's shaking, but it's like normal now. Like this is just my life now.
Yeah.
This is what my body does. And you just kind of get your brain into this, like, well, this is how life is now. And you just,
100%.
You just accept it and you just keep going through it. And you know, you kind of get into this mental state of like, okay, things have changed and I'll adapt to this. And now I'm always fascinated because I mean, look, I put up the Christmas tree with my wife this weekend and I didn't want to do the ornaments on the bottom because I kept having to like squat down. I'm like, I'm tired of like going down. Come back. You do you're shorter. You do the ones on the bottom. That's my mentality toward these things. And here you are like, well, I only got electrocuted 31 times.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's move forward to, so you did that. You put that behind you. Those days are behind. You're at Eastern, you're at Illinois. You go through cancer. You hear about this new race and you're like, I got to do this again.
Yeah. I don't know how either. I don't like, I guess the start is, you know, there for a while, I think it was, you know, after the season got canceled, COVID happened. So like I'm in another, basically another quarantine. I was just quarantined for 3 months with cancer. Now I'm in another quarantine. I don't have anything to do. All of our guys went home. It's not like, I could even work from home. There's nothing to do. We were supposed to be playing baseball.
Right.
So I just sat there every day, just feeling sorry for myself. I did nothing. I had no goals. I was just kind of lost. And then, you know, a couple other things happened, piled on, just, you know, just kicked my butt, to be honest. And finally, I'm like, man, I just got to do something. And so I started kind of getting back after it, working out. I think I lost like 50 pounds in seven, eight weeks, something like that. And I wasn't really training for this race. I didn't even know about it at this point. All I was trying to do was just get my body back to be able to train. And I think it was about 5 weeks before the race, there was the world championship of this race. And I was like, what is this? And I followed it. And then all of a sudden, the next day, it showed up on my Facebook feed. The first time ever, somehow the Facebook knowing what you're looking at paid off. For the first time in my life, the ads and whatever, it worked on me.
You're glad it was listening to you.
I did. And it showed that this was a golden ticket event for the world championship next summer, and it was in Missouri. And I'm like, well, I can drive that. Let's go. And so I trained for 5 weeks to be able to do this. And unfortunately, my last long run, I went back to Charleston to run the trails there. There's a cool trail around Lake Charleston that I run all the time. I love it. A lot of elevation, really, really beautiful scenes, scenery. And my last long run of training, my knee locked up, and I was I knew I was in trouble, but decided to go, decided to try this race. And I guess the format of this race is you run 4.166667 miles per loop. So basically, if you break down 100 miles, you divide 100 by 24 hours. That's how you get the 1.6667 or 4.6667 miles. So if you go 24 hours, you will run 100 miles. This race was tough for me because it's completely opposite of the other one. The other one at World's Toughest Mudder, I was on my own terms. If I wanted to stop for 15 minutes, I could. If I needed to eat a full meal, I could. If I wanted to make it a short, quick little pit stop and go, I could do that. This one, it was not that at all. You have to be on the line every hour on the hour. And so that was kind of difficult for me, for my mind to wrap around that. And then the other was when sometimes, you know, when people would pass me, in the past, when people would pass me, I'm like, no, I can't let them pass me. I got to beat them. This race, every single person is tied for first place every hour. Everybody's tied for first. It does not matter if you finish the loop in 30 minutes and I finish it in 58. As soon as we step on the line the next loop, we're tied for first.
You just have to get it done in an hour?
I have to get it done in an hour, and you have to be at the starting line before the next hour starts.
And the winner of this then is the one who is still going after so many hours, and they still...
One person left. Whoever's the last person left. So some races will go over 2 days. This one went 37 hours. The one I was in, the winner went 37 hours. But it all depends on who gets second. So if that second place finisher can only go 24 hours, then the race is only going to go 25. But if the second place can go 48 hours, well, then somebody's going to be 49. So it all depends on kind of who's your competition as well.
So once there's, say, two guys left, and they both go to the line for hour 37, and 37 just bonks halfway through and is out, does that guy, does the winner still have to do like one more by himself to like prove that he did? It's if two people finish, you keep going.
Correct.
If two people finish, and I guess did it finish that one guy showed up for lap 37 and the other guy's like, I'm out, I can't do this.
I'm out. I believe that's what happened. I was asleep. I was luckily getting some sleep. That was going on.
Where was it in Missouri?
Camdenton, so right near the Lake of the Ozarks.
My family has a place at the Lake of the Ozarks, so I've
Oh wow. Yeah.
And been down there my entire life. So the goal, I guess, of the thing is everybody gets the 24 hours. Like, is that the?
Is there a?
You set your own goal. I'm going to do this, and I want to get to 15. That's my goal. I'm going to knock out 15 laps on this, and then I will have achieved my goal. Or is it just you push until you can't? Or, you know, how did you set it up?
Yeah, so everybody's a little different. With my knee, I didn't quite know, to be honest. I didn't. I just knew I wanted to push myself again. I just knew I wanted to feel. I know this sounds really weird and crazy, but I wanted to feel pain. I wanted to feel torture. I just wanted to feel that feeling again.
Mm-hmm.
And see how far I could push myself. I didn't really have any goals necessarily, just because of my knee. I was going to be in rough shape, and unfortunately, 12 miles in, it locked up, mm-hmm. and I had a giant brace on my knee, like a one that you would have after knee surgery. I mean, with metal and everything.
Yep.
So it cut down my stride length and everything. So like, I guess I didn't have that much of a goal going into it. Mm-hmm. I just knew I wanted to just keep going until I couldn't anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I was almost out of the race at mile. I mean, at mile 12, I was pretty down. At mile 35, 36. I thought I was out.
Mm-hmm.
At hour 9 or 10, the sun was going down. I made a huge mistake. I put on a jacket that just trapped so much body heat. And I think I was like two or three miles in when I realized what was going on, because I started to kind of lose vision and I was swaying back and forth and I just didn't feel right. And then I touched my hat. My hat was absolutely soaked. Mm-hmm. And it was already kind of cold. So I'm like, well, that ain't good. Then I touched my shirt. I'm like, oh gosh, I'm in trouble here. So I remember getting back to the tent, laying, just plopping down on an air mattress and just out of it, and telling my pit crew, I was like, I don't want to be here anymore. I don't know what's going on. Like, blah, blah, blah. I mean, and mm-hmm. unfortunately this happened. I mean, this happens. And that's why the pit crew is so important. And I was so fortunate that they did a great job. Fortunately, two of them had been there with me at World's Toughest Mudder, so they know that there's going to be a lot of lows, but I can get through it, and this is just kind of how I react to it, you know. And I remember at one point I was like, just let me complain for 5 minutes, just let me be a baby for 5 minutes, and then I'll get back out there. Just let me sulk, mm-hmm. just for a little bit, let me get it out of my system, and then we'll go back. And then I don't know how. And then I got to 50 miles. So I'm like, well, if I get to 60, that's the second most I've ever ran. Like, that's not bad for, you know, being 9-10 months past cancer and out of shape. Like, I, you know, that's a cool accomplishment. So I got to 60 and I'm like, well, crap, 15 more, you know, only 15 more miles, I can tie it. And then,
mm-hmm.
I got close to tying it. Well, I'm like, well, now I got to beat it. And then I got to mile 80 and I remember looking at them and I'm just like, I have to go for 100, right? Like, I have to. I would hate myself forever if I quit. I have to at least go for it. And so I went for it and somehow I got it. And I was done after that. I could have went a few more. I probably could have legitimately got 108 point mm-hmm. whatever miles. I could have, but I was pretty much done. Just my knee. My knee was just so screwed up.
Yeah.
So.
And did you, were there any, like, I guess, was it 4.2 miles or whatever? That's not too much danger of being not, like, of not getting there. But, like, were there any hours of, like, you know, you're finding out, hey, I only have so much time left here. I need to finish this lap. I need at least a little rest. You know, I'm only going to get 7 minutes if I really push myself. Like, were there any of those laps that were like, oh man, I might not get this?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, the last 8 hours, I believe. Sorry, my phone's dying. I got my charger.
You're fine.
The last 8 hours, I was last place, I believe, coming in every time.
Yeah.
So I ended up getting, I think I was averaging 4 to 5 minutes in between loops. So I would only have 4 to 5 minutes to do anything, which made for a lot of problems. Mostly it was, I couldn't change my gear.
Yeah.
I didn't have time. And then also, just food. Because usually when I get done running, you know, I want to sit down, I want to rest for 3 or 4 minutes before anything sounds appetizing.
Yep.
And I just didn't have time. So I was coming in, taking like one bite of a peanut butter and jelly, and I'm back out on the line.
Yeah.
So it was tough. It caused for a lot of issues, you know, with coming in late. Just you don't have that rest, but it's more of, I mean, I didn't change my socks one time in 24 hours because I didn't have time.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I only changed shirts 2 or 3 times. So it was just a time crunch. And that was kind of the opposite of World's Toughest Mudder as well. It was just really, really hard to go on their time instead of your own. So I had to adapt. And there were times where I knew, like, hey, I got to push. And so the last, I know, 4 hours, I was pushing as hard as I could just to get in with 4 minutes to go.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. So what's your pit crew selection like? Like, you know, you're choosing people that you know can say the right thing at the right time of, like, somebody who knows you well enough of when to push and when to back off and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So, one of my friends went, it was her first time doing it. And I prepped her before. She had a lot of questions. She did a lot of research. She watched a lot of documentaries about these type of things. Yep. And I just tried to tell based on my past, like, hey, this is like, there's going to be low moments. There's going to be times where I want to quit. There's going to be times where I'm maybe moody or I'm incoherent. Like, here's how you handle it. Try to do it. And she did an unbelievable job. There was one point, actually 2 or 3 loops where I would come in and she had exactly the right food ready without me telling her. I remember one time, hey, I got mashed potatoes. I'm like, oh yes, let's go. But, you know, that sounds great.
Yeah.
It was, I don't know. It was pretty cool too, because I think what saved me was my brother and sister. My sister and brother-in-law, I didn't want them to come with me in the morning because I knew my knee was probably going to lock up. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want them to drive there, take out their whole day, and me be there for 2 hours, and then we go home. And so they waited till 9 a.m., and my knee was fine at 9 a.m., 2 hours in, eight miles in.
Mm-hmm.
Called them, hey, bring it, you know, come on, like, my knee feels great, let's go, you know, let's do this.
Yeah.
And so they hopped in the car, drove from Lincoln, Illinois, 5-hour drive. And hour three, my knee locked up, but they were already on their way.
Yeah.
And I was pretty down and out. And by the time they showed up, I was like, well, I can't quit now. They just drove 5 hours. Like, you have to keep going.
Yeah.
And I think that's what kind of saved me. But having them there was huge too. Like I said, they crewed for me at World's Toughest Mudder my last year. And they knew, they've been through it. They know. I think even one of the videos, you know, I don't remember much of the race, to be honest. But at one point I was watching the video and she said, my sister goes, hey, this is zombie mode. You've been here before. Like, we've been here before in zombie mode. Like,
mm-hmm.
where you're incoherent, you don't know what's going on. Like, we've been here. And it helps that she's calm, you know, because she understands, she's been there.
Yep.
That this is normal. Kind of like what you're talking about with your buddy, the Navy SEALs, of like when you're shaking or whatever, it's just like, okay, this is reality. It's just kind of a mindset of how you're going to adjust, mm-hmm. how you're going to adapt. So it was huge. It was absolutely huge. And then we had a pretty good system going on. Luckily, about the halfway point of the race, you would kind of come right back through the tent, through the aid station, and they'd be there asking me, hey, what are you thinking when you get back? What type of food? What gear adjustments? Is my phone charged? Headphones? I mean, so we could kind of communicate every once in a while about what I might need the next loop. But then there's some loops where I'm incoherent or I don't want to talk or I'm moody or whatever the case may be. And yep. they just have a lot of options ready to go. So, you know, as much as it's a long day for me, the pit crew, man, they go through a lot. I would like to think they have fun doing it at times, but I mean, they're out there for, you know, 24, 26 hours as well. And it's stressful for them and they're trying to do the best they can and can't do it without them. I'm telling you, it's, I've done this four times now. I've won over 24 hours and there's people that look stronger, runners that look stronger than me and maybe are, but maybe they're not prepared or they don't have the right help and they're out of the race. You just, it's just,
for so long in races, you have to have the right people there to help you.
So let me ask, doing these pre-cancer and post-cancer, like your mentality, your thought, your, like, were there any differences this time? I know it's a different race, but were there any differences this time mentally, given what you just went through, like given what the last year had been like for you?
Yeah, when it comes to mentality, like saying it's like mentally strong, I'm not sure that that's a big thing for me after cancer. Just I feel like everything I've been through, especially those other races, helped me, you know, kind of get past that mental part. Yep. I would say the one thing that that changed, enjoying other people. I've never ran with anyone else. I've never wanted to talk to anybody else. I was kind of in my own head and just trying to do my own thing. And I found myself enjoying other people's company a little bit more this time. Mm-hmm. I ran with a gentleman I just met. He's from Kansas City. His name's Kevin. He was 50 years old. And his goal was, I think, 80 miles. And so I guess post-cancer, the only change for me was just appreciation. And then just, you know, just kind of understanding how fragile and how quick life can be. And, yeah. And I guess I think that's the one thing I think that has changed me a little bit post-cancer is just kind of the, you know, the little things and just enjoying a little bit more than in the past. But when it comes to the pain and the getting through tough times, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, cancer was tough. It was brutal, but I think it was – I think it was the aftermath that was harder than the actual chemo. You know, that just kind of felt blah, I mean, no energy.
Yeah,
I think it was, just, I don't know. Some people call it demons, you know, that you hold on to. And every once in a while I would think about, man, you've been through this and you've been through that. Like, you can get through this. But for the most part, I think it's just experience, you know, just getting out and doing something that's uncomfortable. And then the more you do it, it becomes comfortable.
Yeah. Okay, two more questions for you. I won't keep you forever. But
no, you're good.
The first one is rest. So this your 24th hour was when? Sunday or Saturday?
Sunday. It's 7 a.m. on Sunday. So we started at 7 a.m. on Saturday.
Yep.
And so I guess my last loop was between 6 and 7 a.m. on Sunday.
Okay. So we're barely 48 hours beyond. We're recording this Tuesday afternoon. So so what have the last 48 hours been like for you? Rest, like, what do you, like, you have to have the crash of all crashes, right?
You know, well, I surprisingly feel great right now, other than my lower half. My knee, my feet, my calves, hip flexors, everything's pretty shot. Tough to walk right now.
Well, you did do 100 miles just in, you know, you could probably give yourself a little break. Yeah.
Yeah, well, but I don't know. After the race, it happened exactly the way I thought it would, because this has happened, is after the race, I was good for about a half hour. I went to go change, and then all of a sudden I start shaking, and my body was going into shock.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into the car. I couldn't get my feet in the car, but I'm sitting in the car, my feet on the ground, and I couldn't get in. I was shaking so bad, convulsing. And so all that shaking and convulsing and being cold was making my whole body cramp. So I'm just squirming, trying to uncramp, and I'm shaking. And it took forever to get my feet to be able to bend to get in the car.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, and people that weren't probably aware or haven't seen this side were like, well, we're close to taking you to the hospital.
Right.
I'm not going to the hospital. This is what happened. I'm fine. Like, I've been here. We've been, done this. Like, it'll go away. It just sucks right now. Like, it's okay.
Yeah.
But I think then I got to the hotel, and they luckily had a wheelchair.
Uh-huh.
And because there's no way I could have got to the hotel room.
Yeah.
So they got me in a wheelchair and wheeled me in, which was kind of embarrassing, but I had a million blankets over me, so it's not like anybody could see me anyway.
Sure,
so, got into the room and then shook. I mean, you're just constantly shaking. You go from overheated to chilled, to overheated to chilled for a little while. I think I slept for off and on half hour naps, like sleep for a half hour, wake up, sleep for a half hour, wake up.
Uh-huh.
And then pretty much all yesterday we drove home and I slept a little bit yesterday and good night's sleep tonight or last night. But sleep wise, I don't know. I feel pretty good.
I would picture like a 17-hour sleep marathon of like close your eyes on Sunday at 4 and wake up, you know, mid morning Monday or something like that. Like that's
And I think that would happen, but it's like your body's in such pain and shock that you wake up or you need to use the restroom. I mean, there's a lot of a lot of things avoiding, you know, or not allowing you to just pass out for that long. But I sure wanted to and tried. But
yeah. And did you? You were in Missouri. Did you wear Illini gear during the race at all?
Oh, the whole time. By the end of the race, excellent. Everybody. Love everybody was yelling "Go Illini" and "ILL." By the end of the race, I think I wore Illinois gear every single lap.
Perfect. So, this is what we like to hear, especially since we play them on Saturday night. Okay, final question. I mean, I'd be remiss if I have you on here and we didn't talk at least a little baseball. So, you know, I guess we still don't know what the spring season is going to look like, and we still, you know. Seems like there's going to be a season. There's been basketball. There's been football. You know, just give me your thoughts on the team, on where you guys think you were this time last year, or, you know, in the spring last year when it got shut down, and what you think you have coming back.
Yeah, I mean, last year, you know, we played, I would just say we played okay, and our record was pretty good and beat some really good teams. And I just thought we were playing okay, well, which is a good thing. I think that's scary to think about. If we were playing well, you know, what level we could have got to. That's a good thing. And we return a lot of guys back for this year. You know, we lost a couple arms, but got some young guys going to fill those spots well. Got some junior college guys that can help fill those spots. So, you know, obviously really looking forward to this year. No one knows what's going to happen, obviously, you know, with COVID and, but that's just, you know, that's kind of the hand we're dealt. And it's like, all right, whoever can adjust and adapt and take it on, we'll do well. But I like our team, our chemistry. We've got a lot of, you know, guys working really, really hard, a lot of talent. But to me, I think guys want to win, you know, and I think that obviously that's very, very important, especially in a game of baseball where it takes so many guys. You know, you can't just win with 3 or 4 or 5. You need an entire team throughout the season.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, I appreciate it. I mostly appreciate you wearing Illini gear throughout the entire race, the Saturday and Sunday before bragging rights. So that has boosted my confidence in Saturday night and how the game is going to go. So listen, I really appreciate you coming on and telling your story and everything else. And I have no idea how you put your mind through something like that, because I can't even imagine the thought of 100 miles in 24 hours. So, congrats on being able to get your brain, to that level of whatever it needs to be, you know, to make that decision and to do that.
Well, I appreciate it, man.
All right.
Thank you very much for having me, and it was fun. Thank you.
You got to go, Illini. All right. Thanks.
Right. ILL.
I and I.